Welcome to today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is my colleague, Joe Healy. And we are here to wrap up week 13 of college baseball. It was a loaded schedule across the country. There is so much to talk about. We knew this was going to be a packed weekend, and it absolutely delivered. We've got the Big 12 race getting completely upended by Texas Tech sweeping Oklahoma State. We've got Arizona upsetting Oregon State. Out in the Pac-12, we had a top 10 ACC series won by Virginia Tech. We had Florida State winning the rivalry series against Miami. A lot happened in the SEC, including Vanderbilt upsetting Arkansas in Fayetteville. There were some significant conference races. You know, 1 and 2 matched up in Conference USA. Big deal in the Missouri Valley. A lot to get to here on the podcast. Frankly, I don't know how we're going to do it all. So let's get to it, Joe. It was a great weekend of college baseball, a great weekend for the remote control. Maybe not such a great weekend to be at some of these series. Virginia and Clemson, I think, wrapped up 5 minutes ago. But it is, if you dodge the raindrops, it wound up being a great weekend.
Yeah, last week at this time, I said that, if Mother Nature keeps this up, she's going to host a regional. And don't look now, but she's sneaking up on a national seed. So another big weekend for Mother Nature. It's funny, at least out here, we had a really nice week of weather leading up to the weekend, and then the rain came again. So is what it is. I mean, it's that time of year, right? I mean, it's just like the late spring, early summer, when it starts to get warm everywhere. And, you know, in a lot of places, as soon as it starts to warm up, it starts to rain. So the old April showers bring May flowers, although, you know, we're in May now, but the old adage stands, and that's, you know, it's a nice little preview for the postseason, for better or for worse.
That it is. Well, let's go to there's so many places we could start. I think there's only one place to start, though, and that's in Stillwater, where there was no rain. There was, I can't, there might be a pun there. I can't do it. It's fine. Oklahoma State was hosting Texas Tech. There was an awful lot to play for this weekend, especially for Oklahoma State, which, you know, we've talked about how tight this Big 12 race was, how Oklahoma State coming into the weekend was in control of its own destiny in the Big 12. And, you know, really just kind of seemed like they were commanding the Big 12 race, not just in control of their own destiny. That makes it kind of sound like, well, you know, they can do it, but it'll be tough. Like, no, if you looked at it, they probably only needed to go 4-2 over their last six games to win their first Big 12 title since 2014. Instead, Texas Tech rolls into Stillwater and sweeps Oklahoma State. And, you know, they did it in a variety of ways. They went out on Friday night and, you know, needed a bit of a comeback. They got behind early, came back, held off a furious Oklahoma State comeback with one of the wildest endings you will see. Texas Tech only plays weird games. That's what I'm taking from this. We can get into that Friday night end in a sec. And then on Saturday, it was a little more routine. Brandon Birdsell really shut down the Pokes offense. And then Sunday, again, was a tight game. Texas Tech, again, holding off a furious comeback attempt from Oklahoma State, which left the bases loaded in that game. And the end result is Texas Tech sweeps. Texas Tech now controls its own destiny in the Big 12 title race. And Oklahoma State has been eliminated from title contention. Meanwhile, because this is all interconnected, TCU swept Kansas to finish its Big 12 regular season slate. They're playing Santa Clara next weekend. So they're in the clubhouse. They're the leaders at 16-8. That's what everyone's chasing. Setting up a bananas final weekend potentially as Texas Tech is hosting Oklahoma. Both of those teams are still alive. Both of those teams need a sweep. And if they get it, they win the Big 12. If not, TCU wins the Big 12. It's nonsense. It feels like that there are so many permutations it could be, but this is what we've hit on. So Joe, I guess let's set aside the future Big 12 implications. We'll talk about that at length on Thursday, and we can touch on it a little later here, but let's focus on Tech rolling into Obrate Stadium and coming away with 3 wins.
It felt like a series that really just got played on Texas Tech's terms is how I would put it. I mean, yes, Oklahoma State did score two runs on in the first of the first game, and you thought, okay, here we go. But from really that point forward, it felt like Texas Tech series. Even on Friday, when Oklahoma State had some moments on Friday. Friday was the most interesting game of the three. You know, you right down to little individual moments, the way the game ended, 513 foot home run for Griffin Dorshing. It went over the scoreboard in left center, just an incredible home run. And Tech, you know, found a way to hold on and win it. But that felt like Tech's kind of game. You know, they knocked Justin Campbell out of the game relatively early. They, you know, relatively early on Justin Campbell standards, I suppose, got to him pretty good. It was played with a high-ish score. It was, to your point, kind of chaotic, and it seems like that team just likes to play those kinds of games because they sure do seem to end up in them. Big innings were a thing. You know, they had a 5-run inning in the opening game. They had a 7-run inning in the second game. No huge innings in the third game, but did have a 3-run inning. So it just kind of felt like Texas Tech's type of series, and they controlled play from basically beginning to end. And Oklahoma State, for the better part of the series, kind of felt lifeless in some ways. I mean, I don't know if the opening game and how close they came and the way it ended or all of that kind of bled over into the rest of the weekend or not, but they were somewhat uncompetitive on Saturday. It's a little unfair because a seven run inning kind of makes it look that way. But I mean, it really was after that big inning, basically done and dusted on Saturday. And then on Sunday, the score looks pretty close and they made a nice rally in the ninth and had a, you know, we're right there to tie that game, and it didn't happen. But I mean, that game was, you know, 6-1 going into the seventh inning. It had been controlled from start to finish by Tech. So that one wasn't probably even quite that close outside of a relatively close finish. So it was, you know, just exactly what Tech needed. And for Oklahoma State, it was just a real step back. And it kind of goes to show that, you know, this conference has been pretty hard to figure from the very beginning for a lot of different reasons, which we'll get into, like you said, probably more at the end of the week as we look ahead. But this felt kind of par for the course for this league so far this year with the way things have been upended. We've ended up with kind of the same group of teams we thought we'd end up with, but man, how we arrived here is not the way I would have seen it coming.
Texas Tech or Oklahoma State scored the first two runs of the game on Friday in the first two innings. Then Tech comes back with a 5-run fourth inning to take the lead. They would not trail the rest of the weekend. So to your point, Joe, I mean, like, yeah, they really did play this on Tech's terms. There were a couple times later that Oklahoma State was tied in the series, but they never led after the fourth inning on Friday. And I mean, it's remarkable that happened. And there are a number of reasons for it. One of which was, I think, starting pitching. You mentioned Justin Campbell getting knocked out relatively early. It was his worst start of the season. I think that's completely fair to say. It wasn't a terrible start. I think a lot of pitchers would love for what Justin Campbell did on Friday to be their worst start of the season, but nonetheless, it was his worst start of the season. And then on Saturday, I mean, we've talked a lot about how Bryce Osmond isn't getting deep into games, but he really didn't do it on Saturday. And then on Sunday, with Victor Medeiros still sidelined by a back injury, Trevor Martin went back out there to start, and he only made it 2 1/3. He gave up 5 hits and 5 walks, I think that was. I could be conflating something, though. But it just wasn't a good weekend for the Oklahoma State starting group. And it's a team that wants to get to the bullpen relatively quickly. And it's a good deep bullpen, but there just was a lot put on that bullpen, and they entered the game losing every time. And that's not the recipe for success. I think Oklahoma State swung the bats relatively well. They maybe came up short in some clutch situations more often than they would want. But to me, this was a I don't want to say an indictment of the Oklahoma State rotation this weekend, but they did not cover themselves in glory, and it was just a really tough weekend for them against a really good offense. It happens, but they did not step up in the way the Cowboys needed them to.
No, and I think it shows the way in which they're vulnerable, right? I mean, we've kind of known this for a while, and at different times they've kind of papered over it, whether it's you know, Bryce Osmond turning in a good start, which he's done a number of times. Like, he's had good outings, and, you know, or kind of being optimistic about what Victor Medeiros could be. But by and large, for the most part, I mean, it's a team that is pretty vulnerable after Justin Campbell. And so in any weekend when you don't get much from Campbell, not only is that a bummer because, you know, you never want to lose his starts, but also it does set you on course for your bullpen being taxed in the way it did. The way it did this weekend, and they had to go to it early enough that it felt like they weren't able to use the relievers in the way in which they wanted to. They were chasing the game for a lot of it. So, you know, that's always a tough thing to balance if you're a coach, because it's, you know, which arms do you want to use while you're chasing the game versus which arms do you want to use in case or in the event you take the lead, right? So that's a tough way to play a game at any point. And, you know, so it just felt like the bullpen being a strength that it is for them, they weren't able to really use them in the way they would have wanted.
To clean this up real quick, it was not Trevor Martin that gave up 5 hits and 5 walks. That was Jake Fennings, who plays for the other black and orange OSU team, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Fair enough. I thought maybe you were conflating it with the Justin Campbell start, because he gave up 6 hits and 5 walks, and that was pretty close. So, like, I thought that's what you were actually conflating it with. So, you know, interestingly, on the tech side, I mean, it really does. We've talked about this before, so I won't really belabor it too much, but you know, the Andrew Morris Brandon Birdsall combination, you know, Birdsall more than Morris, I mean, Birdsall throwing, like, when he's on, I mean, it's a game-changing arm for them, and really a game-changing arm that Tech doesn't always have, even in good years. You know, they don't have a guy like that at the front of the rotation. They've pieced it together a lot, even in good years. So that's really a game-changing arm for them to have, and Andrew Morris has really been pretty doggone good. And he's 7-0, which is kind of a weird quirk. I'm not someone who puts a lot of stock in wins, but it is kind of a quirk that it's a guy with an ERA closer to 4 than 3, and he's 7-0, which goes to show you that the offense tends to support him pretty well, I guess. But those two have been really, really solid at the front of the rotation. I think it's kind of changed, you know, raised the ceiling a little bit for Tech. And man, I would imagine once they get into maybe not a regional, because if they end up somehow hosting or have a favorable matchup as a 2 seed, Morris probably goes first, but in a super regional, or if they get to Omaha, like, I imagine it'll be in a situation where Birdsall throws first, and he's as good as anybody. Like, he that's how good he is. I mean, the listening to the broadcast when he was pitching, and Tom Holliday does Oklahoma State games on ESPN Plus, and he's, you know, that guy, he's been around a long time, and he's seen a lot of really good pitchers, and he had a lot of really good things to say about just the quality of Birdsall's stuff and the way his stuff just explodes, and when he's going well, how difficult he is to hit. So he's, like I said, he's really kind of raised the ceiling for what Tech can be, and is gives them a chance to outpitch just about anybody in the country on the days he throws, which is not something we're used to saying with Texas Tech.
Yeah, those two guys have been so great. There are a lot of options behind them, and it just feels like Tech can just throw so many different guys at you. And they did that on Friday when they were trying to close that game out. Tadlock went to the mound several times to bring in a new reliever, and they finally were able to get that done. I guess I teased how it ended Friday, and then we didn't actually say. So on Friday, if you haven't seen this highlight, Oklahoma State gets the tying run to third base with 2 outs, and it's a pinch runner, Jackson Kroll. He gets a bad read, I guess, on a dirt ball. The ball never really gets far away from freshman catcher Hudson White, who was doing a great job behind the plate. Like, it was a bit dicey there, with a runner on third and the chance to tie a game, but he gets a pretty good block in. The ball does not leave the dirt area. Kroll comes anyway and winds up in a rundown and getting thrown out at the plate to end the game. I mean, like, Texas Tech is a team that already won a game this year on a walk-off steal of home, and I feel like this one is right up there with that Kurt Wilson steal of home against Texas.
Yeah, for Kroll, it's just tough because you know, especially when you're a pinch runner, like, you know, you're in there for your legs, and you get to third base, and you know, the conversation, you know, whether it came from the dugout or came from the base coach or whoever, is, you know, be aggressive on dirt balls, like, be ready to go, all that kind of stuff. So you're bouncing over there at third, like, you're ready to move, and you see that ball heading for the dirt. It's just hard not to be over exuberant in that moment. And so there was some bad luck to it. Didn't carry him that far. And really, I haven't watched the replay since Friday night. I probably should have gone back and watched it again, but really it kind of struck me that it wasn't close because they ended up getting him in a rundown. So he didn't even try to slide in, but the only reason it wasn't, the only reason he didn't get caught up closer to third base is because it took Hudson White a second to like figure out exactly what was happening. It's almost like he didn't realize he was coming at first because he didn't expect him to. And actually that might end up working in Texas Tech favor, because if Hudson White recovers that ball a little bit quicker, Kroll might have time to turn around and go back. But as it was, he hesitated long enough to let Kroll come down the line a little further, to the point where he got hung up the way he did. So a very Texas Tech in 2022 ending, that one there. But again, they find ways to win games like that. And I don't know if that's a skill or not, but man, they sure do seem to do a good job of it.
I do think it's a bit of a program skill. We're talking about a team that consistently goes to Omaha, consistently competes for Big 12 titles. And, I spoke with Gonzaga coach Mark Matkoff about, is there something to, your program winning, playing this underdog role early in the season and winning series like they did the last 2 years at TCU and Oklahoma State. And, he said, he does think that there is something to that, that eventually you do that enough as a program, players start to expect that, veterans tell the younger players that, we're going to go and we're going to win this stuff. And I feel like the same thing can be true here, that Texas Tech has won enough of these crazy games over the years that they never feel like they're out of a game. That is the feeling, you get that feeling enough times that older players pass that on to younger players. And I think there might be something to that. And there's a reason why Tech has been as consistent as they have been under Tim Tadlock. And he's a really good game manager. Not many coaches, I don't think, would put Kurt Wilson on for a steal of home there. He's good in these moments. And I think that rubs off on the team and that all compounds. And now Tech is in a position to again play for a Big 12 title. And look, even if they don't get it done, even if they, tie with TCU, and because they only win the series against Oklahoma as opposed to sweeping it, they'll say they shared the Big 12 title. They won't have the tiebreaker. They won't, be the number one seed in Arlington. But this is a team that I had not been taken seriously as a potential host for weeks due to their RPI. That is now very much back on the table, though they're only in the 30s. But with a series against Oklahoma, who also has an RPI in the 30s, this is a chance for Tech to win some more games and make up some more ground and, get into the right range to host. I think it's a little less necessary that this Tech team hosts than some in the past. They've actually played pretty well on the road. This is part of it, but obviously playing in Lubbock in June is usually a huge advantage. It didn't work out that way in super regionals last year, but the history is such that it is it's a big time home field advantage. Before I go crazy on what Tech has done and what they still can do, though, Joe, I do want to throw this out there. Maybe we should have seen this coming, because Tech has not lost in Stillwater since 2014. They're 15-3 against Oklahoma State over the last 5 years. It's insanity what that is, but it's remarkable.
Yeah, that's a pretty, because Oklahoma State's been good for all that. Oklahoma State, by the way, I was reminded of this when I saw a graphic on one of the games I was watching yesterday, that Oklahoma State, the longest regional streak in the Big 12. I think theirs goes back to 2013, whereas Tech's picks up in 2014, I believe. I think that's the difference there, but regardless.
Tech maybe missed in 15.
Yeah, regardless. Because I think people would think Tech probably.
Right.
But yeah, so Oklahoma State though. And there's been some close calls there. Oklahoma State won a tournament one time to get in, that kind of thing. But that's an interesting little nugget there. I think it's this is a trademark of this team not playing well in Stillwater, although that is also the case. But I've had coaches tell me unprompted, just in conversations where we're shooting the bull, they'll just say, man, I wish my team played with an edge like Texas Tech does. I kind of wish I could put some of that into my team, because they come at you and they come at you and they come at you and they have an edge and they play hard and you never have to doubt that. And so Yeah, I mean, I think that's what, if it's anything, that's what it is really just kind of an attitude thing. And that's, I think that's how you end up in situations like they end up in, and they're able to win games the way they win them is because of the kind of edge they have there. So it is not, certainly not, we're not letting it go unnoticed, and it's certainly not going unnoticed around the rest of the country either.
All right, gut right now, does TCU hold on to this thing? They're in the clubhouse, like I mentioned, at 16-8, having demolished Kansas and Lawrence this weekend. Tech needs a sweep. Oklahoma needs a sweep. Oklahoma State's out of it. Can TCU win this thing outright? Or, you know, will they be the number one seed when you're in Arlington in like a week from today?
Yeah, I think TCU ends up holding on. Like, I just think both Tech and Oklahoma are too good to be swept. So I think it'll be TCU doing the ultimate definition of backing its way into a Big 12 title. Just with
I don't know, they're 5-1 against Oklahoma State and Tech. I don't want to say they backed in. They got some help, but they also made some of this themselves.
Yeah, for sure. I just meant like they're sitting on the sidelines. And, yes, you know, yes, they're not doing anything about it, and that's more what I mean, backing their way. And you know, it also. Like, all these teams have had this opportunity, like literally all these teams we're talking about, except Oklahoma, I guess, which has kind of like pushed its way into the mix a little bit later, but they've for the most part just kind of taken care of business. But all the rest of the teams have had this opportunity. Like, this has really been there for the taking for these teams. If one of these teams would have stood up and just kind of taken control of this thing, and instead they've kind of had this circular firing squad situation where they've, you know, they've all got big series wins against each other. They've all got a series loss that was an opportunity. And that's kind of how we've ended up where we've ended up.
Yeah. I think as good as Tech played this weekend, I mean, asking them to sweep the Sooners is a lot. Oklahoma is playing well themselves right now, and obviously is going to be plenty motivated going into Lubbock. So I would lean TCU as well, but I don't think it's going to be an outright title. I told Joe before we started the podcast, I could do the whole podcast about the Big 12, and I promise we are about to move on. But Joe, one last thing. Should we be concerned about Oklahoma State? This is a team that, you know, we thought was very good all season long. There is something to be said now, though, that it's lost the series to arguably the best three teams it's played: Gonzaga, TCU, Texas Tech. All three of those were in Stillwater. Two of those were sweeps. They do have that series win against Vanderbilt. It did sweep Texas and Austin. It did win the Bedlam series, although it is just 2-2 against Oklahoma if you throw in the Tuesday game. How good are the Pokes?
I think there's like a nuanced answer here. Like, I think they're very good. I think they've spent a lot of time in the top five and top 10 on their own accord, sure. But also, it's hard to separate them being ranked that high for a lot of the season with the fact that outside of Tennessee and Oregon State, we've just had a lot of movement inside the top 10. And it's been kind of hard for those teams that we've generally thought are good to not be in the top 10 for a lot of this season because of some of the attrition we've had. The top 10 has not firmed up in a way that sometimes it does. I guess in a way it has, because it's the same teams, but it's those same teams kind of cycling back through. I've always been a little bit worried about Oklahoma State from the standpoint of the thing that happened this weekend could happen. Like, I don't have a whole lot of trust in their starting pitching, and we can look at their bullpen and say, well, it's a real strength, but like, it's hard to play on that strength unless you come from a position of power. So either your offense needs to get going pretty quickly in games, or you need to get some length from your starters. Your bullpen doesn't really do you a ton of good unless you're able to make comebacks late in games. And that's just asking a lot. And so I've been concerned about their starting pitching for a while. I think sometimes their offense also feels a little bit, not maybe home run heavy, but just kind of, we need a big extra base hit to clear the bases here. And a lot of times that gets expressed in home runs. And Griffin Dorsching being back and doing his thing has been helpful in that regard, but it does feel like a little bit reliant on that for my taste. So I think it's a very good team, and it's important to remember, if they're able to take care of business this coming weekend on the road against Baylor and show something in Arlington, it's a team that has a chance to be playing at home in June. And I think this time of year, when we talk about this league, when we talk about the ACC, when we talk about the SEC, it's important to remember that when you're hosting a regional, you're probably not going to see teams really as good as the best teams in your own conference. So you don't have to necessarily play your absolute best to win a regional all the time when you host regionals. That's why you want to host regionals, right? So anyway, long story short, I think this is a very good team. I think it's a flawed one. I just don't think that really separates them all that much from most of the rest of the country, up to and including Texas Tech. Like, we're all over Texas Tech now because they swept this series and looked great doing it. But there are reasons this year to doubt Tech as well. So at various times, we came into the weekend kind of casting a side eye to them. So I just think that's the reality we have, is like, we could sit here and probably go through the entire top 25 and come up with reasons to worry about them, including Oklahoma State. And I think this weekend kind of exposed the, I don't want to say worst case scenario, but it exposed exactly how this Oklahoma State team is a little bit vulnerable moving forward.
So my concern with Oklahoma State is basically that it has now kind of laid an egg. Like, it went 1-2 against TCU, and like, it had huge opportunities against TCU and Texas Tech to go out and say, we are going to win the Big 12 this year. And they didn't get it done either time. I kind of wonder how they handle success. That might not be the most fair thing. I would want to like examine the schedule a little bit more. But it just really strikes me that they had an opportunity at home twice now to really just end the Big 12 race, or, you know, they couldn't have ended it this weekend, but they could have really put their stamp on it and said, all we have to do is go into Baylor and win a series. And they couldn't get it done either time. And both times were at home, and both times were against good teams, but not, you know, we're not talking about, I'm not asking them to have beaten Tennessee to do this, you know, like, I just, if this is a team that you're looking at and saying, yeah, it's a good team, they can host a regional. Yeah. Like, they're that kind of team. Are they the kind of team that shows up in Omaha? I don't know about that. And maybe when Medeiros is able to get right and get back into the rotation, maybe it'll be a different story. Having him back would certainly help in some way, but it just, I don't know what it is necessarily that's lacking with this team, but twice now, they've come up empty in a home series that would have really dramatically, you know, changed their whole outlook. You know, right now we're talking about, well, they could host, but I mean, if they win this series, we're talking about, yeah, that's the top 8 seed. And that's just such a different deal. And to have it happen twice in Obrey and to go 1-5 in those series, and you can throw in the Gonzaga series too. Like, that to me is, it gives me a lot of pause with Oklahoma State now going into the postseason. All right. Let's go out west. Let's go to that other black and orange team with the initials OSU that lost series this weekend. Oregon State was the number one team in the country. That lasted for a week. They went to Tucson and they lost Arizona this weekend. They won on Friday, 12-9. They overcame Arizona getting to Cooper Jerpy in a way that nobody has this season. But they could not finish the deal. Arizona comes back, wins the next two games. Massive series win for Arizona. Not so much in like it changes their postseason outlook. There will be a 2 in my projections this week instead of a 3. Maybe that means something. Maybe it doesn't. But what it definitely does is, after losing a series last week at last place, Southern Cal, it arrested any sort of slide before it could have started by flipping the script and going out and beating first place Oregon State. Arizona has one of the strangest resumes in the country. They have series losses to the teams that are 9, 10, and 11 in the Pac-12 standings right now. The three teams that would miss the Pac-12 tournament started today. Arizona lost a series to all of them. It also has series wins against Stanford and Oregon State, the two teams competing for the Pac-12 title. So go figure that. I sure can't, but this was a big one for Arizona. Their offense came to play. They scored the most runs. They scored 24 runs this weekend. That's the most runs Oregon State has given up in any weekend this year. And I mean, that's what I would expect the Wildcats to do at home, is score a bunch of runs and take advantage of the fact that you're playing in high Corbett and go out and win a series. But we just haven't seen that from them consistently this season, but they sure did it this weekend against the Beavers.
Yeah, we talked before the season about how UCLA, being as young and talented as they are, was going to be a team that would have big highs and maybe some low lows. And that has actually kind of been true, but Arizona State is like the extreme example of that. And it's not really what we predicted for that, for this particular team. And there's some younger pieces, but there's a lot of veteran pieces on this team. But regardless, they showed what they can do this weekend. And it feels like Friday's game was so interesting in that, well, a few things. One is that it really was pretty close. I mean, it's hard to say this because it was a 7-run inning for Oregon State late in the game, but it was, you know, it was 5-5 going to the eighth inning. Like, that's how close it was to being maybe an Arizona sweep here. But the Friday game is interesting because Oregon State had to feel like, man, we really dodged a bullet there. Like, Arizona took it too jerpy and we still managed to win the game. Like, whew, let's wipe our brow, move on. We have to feel pretty good about that. Arizona, meanwhile, you know, probably felt like that was a real missed opportunity. Oh, we actually got to jerpy and now we lost that game. So, you know, if we want to win this series, we're going to have to, you know, the next 2 days. And then of course the series just kind of turns right after that. It was a good offensive series for Arizona. We talked earlier this season about the offense feeling a little bit top heavy, you know, Susacco, Trimba, you know, and Chase Davis hitting a bunch of home runs. And like, outside of that, it was pretty inconsistent. That has been better in conference play, I feel like. So that has kind of come around a little bit. Feels like the depth is a little bit better there. It feels a little bit more settled offensively. So I think this was Arizona showing that what its ceiling is, you know, after maybe feeling like, you know, this team felt like it was probably just a team that was good, but not great. And it still probably is, but it wasn't looking like a team that I had any sort of conviction about, hey, this team could win a regional. I thought they would probably fall short of that, but this, if they can do this against Oregon State, they can do this in a regional. They could do this in a super regional. They could get to Omaha. Like, all of that is still in front of them if they play like they did this weekend. And a lot of things went right. They got a really good start from Garrett Irvin. Don't forget about Garrett Irvin. Like, he turns in starts like that periodically. They got really good bullpen work. Mack Bingham continues to swing the bat well. It's a guy who's hitting .277 overall and .358 in conference, which is just an incredible turnaround for his season. So a lot of things went right. And there are a lot of teams you could point to that could do big things if a lot of things go right. But it's an Arizona team that, you know, felt like it hadn't had a lot of things go right lately. And so they certainly needed this weekend. If it doesn't fundamentally change their postseason outlook necessarily, but it probably does change the way we think about them and maybe the way they think about themselves.
I think that's important because, you know, if they had, you know, after losing to USC, they were facing series against Oregon State and Oregon to finish the year. If that USC series loss starts beating you more than once, I mean, those are two good teams you're facing in the Beavers and the Ducks, and all of a sudden that compounds. And I mean, now you're going into the postseason in a funk. And so I think it was big from the standpoint of stopping the slide. The fact they got two wins instead of just, you know, playing well and winning a game and being like, oh, hard luck loss, whatever. Like, I think that is materially important. I also think that, you know, this doesn't change how they think about themselves probably, and it doesn't change their outlook, but it does, it gives me food for thought. And it's this, that they now, in their three biggest series, I would say, their three biggest weekends, Stanford, Oregon State, and opening weekend when they played in Arlington, they've won all of those. In fact, they've only lost one game in any of those three weekends, and it was a game started by maybe the best pitcher in college baseball this year. Now, Chirpy wasn't great that game, but it was that game. They just seem like a team that can really rise to the occasion. The one time they didn't is when they lost to UCLA at home. But if you look at their series losses, they're very confounding. It's those three that we mentioned in the Pac-12, plus also Texas State, before anyone realized that Texas State was the best team in the Sun Belt and a top 25 caliber team. I just wonder, is this a team that struggles to get up for, you know, those kinds of series? And if that's true, and that they can rise to the occasion, and that they do have this very high ceiling that they've shown against Stanford and Oregon State, Well, then that would seem to bode pretty well for the postseason. They aren't going to get to play at home, but you know, if they play better when the lights are the brightest, I mean, that's the postseason. So maybe there's some reason for optimism about that. Now, obviously there's a flip side to that, which is like, well, you don't want your team to be that temperamental. And if they just played better in some of those series against the bottom quarter of the Pac-12, they could be hosting a regional and all the rest of it. But if you want to take it from a little more positive angle, like when the lights are brightest, Arizona seems to thrive.
Arizona is the photo negative of Oklahoma State. You know, it's like Oklahoma State, you know, has trouble with those big series, and they really kind of take care of business against everybody else without much drama. And Arizona creates a lot of drama when it doesn't need to be, and you know, gets up for the big series, which that is the positive spin of looking at it. That is the way I would tend to look at it. You know, of course, you and I talked about this when we were talking about the rankings last night. The other side of it is that, like, this is an Arizona team that probably should be hosting, you know, and that's not the reality, which is, I was going to say, it's fine. It's not really fine. That's what they want to do, but it is what it is. But yeah, they are the kind of the equal and opposite reaction to Oklahoma State.
Quickly here, Joe, are you concerned about Oregon State? They have now lost series against Stanford and Arizona, arguably maybe the two hardest series that they've played this year, against Stanford and now at Arizona.
Yeah, this one is a no. I'm not really worried too terribly much given this. I mean, unless you believe that this tough start for Cooper Jerpy is the start of some, like, a trend in that direction versus just like, it happens. I mean, that would be worrisome, but I don't believe that. I just think they have so many ways they can beat you, right? I mean, the bullpen is good. The starting pitching, obviously Jerpy's the big name, but the starting pitching in general has been good. The offense is varied and can beat you a lot of different ways. Teams that are that well-rounded, I tend to have a little more belief in. And so there's a reason we have them ranked number two and didn't really have any, well, some of it was the teams behind them losing too, but you know, this is still a number two team in the country. I still think there's a little bit of a difference between them and kind of the rest of the field in the top 25. So no real worry there. Although, you know, it does make it clear that, hey, you know, it doesn't matter how, I mean, we saw this with Tennessee against Kentucky. We saw this now with Oregon State, that it doesn't matter how good you are, like, in these small samples, you can get beat. And that's a real wake up call for the postseason, as if any of them really needed it.
Yeah. I found it hard to believe that they're going to have this kind of weekend on the mound again. I just believe in them so much in terms of what they do from a pitching standpoint. And most of weeks, Jerpy's going to give you more innings, so you aren't going to use Ferrer as much as they did on Friday. And then maybe they're able to get Kmatz a little faster than they did. He was so good to start that game and then hit trouble, I think it was in the seventh. So these things all have cascading effects. And I mean, obviously, this does show you that, like, this is a way you can beat them. But I just don't know how many offenses they're going to face like Arizona. Arizona, at its best, one of the best in the country. Daniel Susak is a first rounder. Tanner Otremba is like this wonderful veteran hitter who's having an amazing year. Chase Davis has first round potential next year. I mean, there's a lot to that lineup, and especially a lot in Tucson. So not terribly concerned about Oregon State, but they do now need a good finish against UCLA, not only to, you know, feel good going into the Pac-12 tournament, but also just to win the Pac-12. They have a one game lead now on Stanford, and Stanford owns the tiebreaker. So Oregon State at least needs to match whatever Stanford does this weekend to go out and win the Pac-12 championship.
No one has a business like yours with all its strengths and challenges. To succeed, you need a hiring partner that adapts to your needs. You need Indeed. Indeed is the hiring platform where you can attract, interview, and hire all in one place. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring partner that can help you do it all. Find great talent faster through time-saving tools like Indeed Instant Match, assessments, and virtual interviews. With Instant Match, over 80% of employees get quality candidates whose resumes on Indeed match their job description the moment they sponsor a job, according to Indeed data in the U.S. I'm talking to you about this because I'm a real live Indeed success story. Part of my job at Baseball America as editor-in-chief is to do hiring. And we had an opening for a creative director and a chief technology officer recently. In both of those cases, we posted to Indeed. We found quality candidates, and we found the people that we hired through Indeed. And because Indeed made the process so easy, it allowed me to go back to what I prefer to doing and what I is my main job, which is covering baseball. And we saw with Indeed that the posting process was easy. The evaluation process was easy. Even the process by which we offered someone the job and told everyone else, we're sorry, but we went in a different direction. All easier because of Indeed. And Indeed is the only job site where you only pay for applications that meet your must-have requirements. So start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/baseballamerica. That offer's good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/baseballamerica. That's Indeed.com/baseballamerica. Terms and conditions apply. Pay per qualified applicant not available for all users. You need to hire. You need Indeed.
All right. Welcome back to the Baseball America College Podcast. We are recapping week 13 here after a jam-packed week of college baseball. So packed, Joe, that we haven't even gotten to the SEC yet. So let's head to the SEC. A lot happened this weekend. Tennessee won the SEC title. They win their first outright SEC regular season championship since 1995. We certainly saw that coming over the last, I don't know, month, but it finally happened. And they did so, you know, with a whole weekend to spare because they were playing this Thursday to Saturday this weekend. It's a little hard to say how many days they did it with to spare because they were, you know, ahead of schedule this weekend. But still, they get it done very early. And, you know, just an impressive season. Again, Tennessee beats Georgia this weekend, and we'll get into the Vols and how they handled their pitching. We also had a top 25 series in Fayetteville as Vanderbilt goes down and wins a series against the Hogs. Kind of a significant upset there that leaves Texas A&M in first place in the SEC West by virtue of the tiebreaker. A&M now up into the top five of the Baseball America top 25, something that Joe and I definitely expected coming into the season. And also in the SEC West, in terms of upsets, Ole Miss goes into Baton Rouge and sweeps LSU for the first time ever. Ole Miss left for dead by many, including us, a few weeks ago. Roars back to life in terms of their NCAA tournament hopes. That really upset the apple cart and also provided kind of a really cool moment. On Sunday, LSU was having its senior day. And of course, Mike Bianco's son, Drew Bianco, plays for LSU, was among the honorees. And so his father was able to be there for that. That's a pretty cool moment, no matter how weird it might've been, because Drew Bianco did get into the on deck circle, in the ninth inning as LSU was trying to rally. Did not happen that he had to hit in that moment, but it was a cool moment pregame to see the Biancos be able to celebrate all together. Okay, Joe, where do you want to take it from there?
Quickly on Tennessee, first title since 1995, obviously, like we've seen the resurgence in that program. So that those types of stats don't really faze me anymore, I guess, just because they've done a lot of first since or best since in the last couple of years. But, doing it this early is, you know, last year we had Arkansas was so dominant during the regular season. Tennessee this year has been so dominant.
Vanderbilt in 2019 as well.
Yeah. So like, my inclination, yeah, that's actually even better, because I was going to say my inclination is to think that, well, this stuff just doesn't happen. But now we've had two in a row, and it turns out three in a row. So that is interesting. Some really dominant teams in that league. So that's my take on that. That's all I have there. A&M is just so fascinating, because I think a couple things can be true here. One is they have overachieved our expectations for them. I think overachieved.
And everyone's, not just us.
Yes. Yes. I was going to say, and overachieved anybody's expectations for them. That is 100% true. Like, there's a lot of things that have gone really right out there. Nathan Detmer hasn't been as good the last couple of weeks, but he's been a real revelation for them. You know, they've got a lot of guys in the bullpen that are doing a lot. The offense has been very, very good with a mix of like the transfers like Dylan Rock and Jack Moss, guys who have been in the program like Ryan Targotch. Like it's so they've just got a lot of stuff cooking there. The other thing is it is indisputable that they have just also done a really good job of taking advantage of the fact that in the middle of the SEC is just a lot of kind of mush, you know? And someone has to kind of take advantage of that. Someone has to fill in those power vacuums. And I think more so than any team in the SEC this year, A&M has been the one that's really taken the bull by the horns, and they deserve, that might sound like a backhanded compliment. And I guess maybe it is, but I don't mean it that way. Like someone had to fill in that vacuum and take advantage of that. And A&M's done it. Like A&M saw that, hey, there's an opportunity here, and they've won games they needed to. And now they're in a position to do all kinds of things that we never would have expected them to be able to do back in, I mean, I was going to say February, but heck, I mean, back in early April, we wouldn't have expected them to be able to do those things. So an incredible turnaround there. And again, it's, you know, a combination of things that have led to it, but they deserve credit for being able to do it. There are a lot of other teams that have had that opportunity and haven't been able to do it as well.
I mean, I came on the podcast sometime in February and said, you know, teams that lose series to Ivy League teams aren't in the habit of, you know, making the NCAA tournament. And here A&M is, they're going to host. You know, that's the track they're on right now. And they're winning the SEC West after finishing last in the SEC West a year ago. It's remarkable. And yes, they've done a really good job winning the games that they should win, but they've also gone out. I mean, the reason why they're in first place right now, I mean, they are tied with Arkansas, but they own the tiebreaker because they went out and they beat Arkansas. They did it at home. But you know, that just goes back to the, yeah, win the games you're supposed to win, win your home games. And A&M is out there doing it. They aren't, you know, they aren't buzz sign teams very often. There are not a lot of sweeps on their resume, but they go out and you know, they win games. And you could also say, well, slightly advantageous crossover schedule, didn't play Tennessee, blah blah blah. Like, that's all fine. Bottom line here, A&M was not expected to be in this position. They are. They've gotten so much better over the course of the season. And look, if A&M went on some sort of run in the postseason, I would not be the least bit surprised. I also would not be the least bit surprised if, you know, they sputter a little bit in the postseason. There is a lot of postseason experience from guys like Troy Klaunch and Jacob Palish, who are the transfers in. And there's plenty of postseason experience in the coaching staff, but it is also, you know, it feels like they're walking a thin line at times. And those are the kinds of teams that if they, you know, if they fall into a loser's bracket, how are they going to react to that and all the rest of that? And we'll just have to see. Nothing that A&M does the rest of the season is going to surprise me. And that includes, you know, seeing them in Omaha, frankly. Like they have earned that. And yeah, so very impressive there. Let's talk about why they're now tied for first place. Cause yeah, they went out and they swept Mississippi State, and so props to them for doing that. But they wouldn't be there if Vanderbilt hadn't gone to the hog, gone to the hog pen and won that series. Vanderbilt and Arkansas was an interesting matchup. We broke it down on the Thursday podcast. And, you know, we talked about a variety of things. And yet in the end, it was basically just Vanderbilt outpitched Arkansas. That was kind of my read on the weekend, especially on Sunday, playing a shortened game in the finale because of the SEC rule that says if you play doubleheader on getaway day, second game has to be seven innings. They're resuming a suspended game was how they got into that scenario. And then Carter Holton went out and threw a two-hit shutout in that seven inning game to lead Vanderbilt to the win in the rubber game.
Yeah. A huge game obviously for Vanderbilt, cause they were going to have, especially in order to be a top eight, but even to feel good about hosting, they were probably going to need to flip a series at some point down the stretch. And then they flipped one here. So big in that regard, but I think big individually for Carter Holton, continuing a trend for him the last few weeks, because it looked, if you go back 5 or 6 weeks ago, he was too talented to just throw a blanket over it and say, oh, they figured him out. but freshmen do sometimes tend to, not just the freshman wall, the proverbial freshman wall, although that happens, but also freshmen do, the books get out on them and the scouting gets better and teams have a better approach, all that kind of stuff. And it is hard for a freshman to break through that. And the last few weeks, Carter Holton seems to have broken through that. His last three starts, 18 innings pitched, 10 hits, no runs. That'll do the trick. This was the best start of them all, considering opponent, and even the numbers bear that out. So that's huge for Vanderbilt. They're gonna need him, because you know the two starts they got the other 2 days of the weekend were, you know, weren't anything really to necessarily write home about. The bullpen ended up picking up some slack, but Devin Fittrell gave up 4 runs and in his 5 innings, McIlvain gave up 6 runs, 5 earned in 4 innings. So they needed him for a couple of different reasons on Sunday, and he really gave them what they were looking for. And he's the type of guy in terms of stuff, like he's going to be in big spots in the postseason. Like he's prepared for that. He's got the stuff to succeed. He, you know, has dealt with these ups and downs. So that was just big, big, big. Big picture, like the, go ahead, unless you were going to.
Well, I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, what they got out of the other two starters was, I mean, it was fine considering, you know, you're on the road, you're playing Arkansas. But for then Holton, the freshman who has been good, but you know, he's been a part of that rotation, but there have been some, you know, been some rough patches for him to step up on that stage on Sunday in a game that meant as much as that did. I think that was a really big deal.
My big picture thought too is that this game really turned on the Friday game, which was a 10 inning game. Did that one get flipped over to Saturday, or did they finish?
No, I think they completed that one.
Yeah, I keep losing track this weekend because it seemed like every game got rolled to the next day. Anyway, regardless,
it got completed, but it got completely overshadowed by the situation in the stands, which we can touch on in a second.
Indeed. Yes, I forgot about that. No, it just I think that was kind of typical of this Arkansas team, and we've kind of felt weird about them. Like they keep winning games, but we're not always sure how. And we've talked about, like, they just seem to kind of, like Texas Tech, they just seem to kind of find a way. Friday's game is a type of game that Arkansas tends to win. It's kind of ugly, back and forth, not a lot of great pitching. And it was Vanderbilt that got the big hit in the end. It was a Enrique Bradfield Jr. 3-run homer in the 10th. And that's like the original recipe for Arkansas. You know, they've kind of lost the original recipe here, where they tend to win these kind of games that get a little bit uglied up and come down to a couple of big hits. And we've talked about that a little bit throughout the season, that, you know, last year's team, as charmed a life as they were living and as talented as they were, there were a lot of moments where it was like every time you turned around, Arkansas was hitting a massive home run in a clutch moment. And they just haven't had that quite as much this year. And it struck me on Friday, this is the type of game they tend to win. And quickly, another spare thought on that is, like, you know it and I know it, but for the average college baseball fan, like, Enrique Bradfield Jr. is a superstar. Like, he has figured out the power. Like, he's got 7 home runs this year, which you look at him and you're like, you know, I don't know if he has the strength to get the ball out. He does. Also 39 for 39 in stolen bases, which is just insane to not get thrown out once when you get a bad read, or the catcher just makes a perfect throw, or you kind of stumble out of the gate or whatever. Like, to not get caught one time attempting 39 stolen bases is just incredible. So that home run in the 10th inning of the Friday game was a hallmark moment for him, but it was just a really good weekend for him. And we didn't need any more evidence to know how good that guy is, but man, he certainly gave us some more.
To your point, in that 10th inning, it looked like Arkansas was going to wriggle out of a pretty tight jam. You know, Brady Tigard had allowed runners on base. Vanderbilt botched a suicide squeeze attempt. Carter Young did not get the bunt. He got the bunt down, but didn't get far enough. The catcher was able to pick it up. And Javi Vaz tried to hit him with a spin move at home plate, and obviously that wasn't working. And so, you know, they get to Bradfield with 2 outs in the inning, and Tigard, I think, got to 2 strikes on him. Even like Tigard looked like he was about to escape this pretty tight jam. And then Bradfield did what he did. And it was the kind of moment that you saw so many times last year with Arkansas and have seen so many times this year, You know, Robert Moore comes up in a big spot, or Jalen Battles runs into one, or, you know, any number of guys on that Arkansas team are capable of those moments. And over the last 2 years, they've delivered on them. But on this night, it was Vanderbilt. And that was a huge deal that Vanderbilt was able to pull that one out there. Also, we got to touch on what happened in the stands on Friday night. Friday night was a wild time at Baum Walker. There was a raccoon in the stands. I think it was down the left field line somewhere, not on the actual, you know, grassy berm hog pen area. It was in the actual stands, and an Arkansas fan like wrangled that thing by himself. he grabbed the raccoon by the scruff of its neck, and they walked him out of the stadium. And that is amazing. But my favorite thing about that whole situation was there was one angle where the guy is like first pulling the raccoon up, and there's a guy in the row, and it looks like he like faints. I don't know if he actually fainted or just was trying to get out of the way, and he like collapses over one row of stands into another. But it looked like it was just two completely diverging reactions to this thing. You know, one guy like going at the raccoon and grabbing it, and the other guy like looks like he faints and falls over a row of stands. It was you don't get that kind of divergent reaction in one cell phone shot too often, but we got that at Baum Walker.
That guy knew how to handle a raccoon. He knew what he was doing. Like that's no amateur there handling that raccoon that way. It also struck me, by the way, that, you know, we go to these replay reviews right on the field, and sometimes it's just like, well, we just don't have a camera angle that is going to show this play exactly the way we need it to show us. And yet, like, within 5 minutes of this thing happening at Arkansas, there were like 900 different angles of this from people's cell phone cameras.
I saw plenty of reverse angles, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, this thing was as well documented as anything that has ever happened. And God bless them, because I watched just about every one of them. But yeah, we can't always get good angles on replays, but man, we really had that raccoon situation covered.
That's what it's all about, you know?
Yeah, I'm not arguing that it should be the other way around. I'm just pointing out a fact, you know?
Yes. All right. One last series to clean up here in the SEC. I guess two more. Joe, do you have anything to say about Ole Miss? Because I'm left kind of speechless that this team has been able to find itself in this way, that they went in to LSU, an LSU team that looked like, you know, it was running towards a host spot, and now is not. Definitively, but Ole Miss has pulled itself together. They got right, and like before this weekend, you could say, "Well, they're playing some of the worst teams in the SEC. Like, how real is this?" Well, going into the box and sweeping makes it feel pretty real that Ole Miss has figured something out.
Yeah, just quickly on that. I mean, it was always, to me, like where we got over our skis a little bit, because this team has disappointed. They are going to finish the regular season in a disappointing relative to preseason expectations. But the idea that, like, even at the worst of it, and I fell into this a little bit, I'm not pointing fingers at others and not at myself. Like, I kind of fell into this too. But in hindsight, it's one of those deals where the pitching was struggling and the offense was struggling too, but those two things struggling so badly at the same time. And the mound was more pronounced because I think we actually believed that more, because we knew pitching was a shortcoming for this team, like even going into the season. But the idea that wasn't going to get any better, I think was like a little bit foolhardy. And it seemed like, well, they're just never going to get it fixed. And like, it has gotten fixed to a degree greater than I expected. Like, I did not expect them to go on this kind of run. But the idea that they were never going to figure something out on the mound, I think, was a little bit foolhardy. But it seemed like, maybe I'm building a straw man argument here, which I don't intend to do, but it did feel like there was kind of a feeling of like, well, this just is who they are on the mound, and they're really scrambling, and you know, they're just going to miss the postseason. They might have to fight to get to Hoover. Like, that really seemed like what had taken over. And sure, they took care of business against Missouri, but you're right, going to Baton Rouge, you know, even with an LSU team that has its own questions, but sweeping them is just an incredible feat. And, you know, these guys are talented. Like, this is a talented team. They have been disappointing, but the idea that they just weren't going to get any better, I think, was a little bit foolhardy there for a while. And it feels like maybe we got a little out over our skis, making assumptions about the way this team was going to finish the season.
They play A&M this weekend. They go into that at 13-14. One win probably is enough here. Maybe don't lose on Tuesday in Hoover. If you don't win this series against A&M, win the series and you're fine. But yes, one to two wins over the next week should be enough here for Ole Miss to make the postseason. All right, let's circle all the way back to Tennessee for a second here, Joe. I was fascinated by the way Tennessee, it's really now going on 2 weeks that Tennessee has been kind of messing around on the mound, giving guys breaks. This weekend, that meant that the freshmen, Chase Burns and Drew Beam, who've been in the rotation all season long, did not start. They came out of the bullpen instead. You got starts from Dollander and Tidwell. No real surprises there. But then they rolled out Ben Joyce as a starter for the first time on Saturday. He threw four innings. He threw 53 fastballs. All of them were at least 100 miles an hour. So that's a new development. He's now twice in the last three weekends thrown four innings in a game. And I don't know that they're going to ask Ben Joyce to start a game in the postseason at any point. Tony Vitello made the point that, you know, he was a part of the 2006 Missouri coaching staff when Mizzou, you know, went to the Malibu Regional and won it and needed to play five games. If you want to win the SEC tournament, you're playing four or five games. So you need more than three starters is the overall point here. Now, whether Joyce ever actually starts a game in the postseason or whether he is now just being stretched out for long relief, which is what the first of those four inning appearances came in. Either way, it seems clear that the Tennessee is now taking the reins off him, that they trust him to throw enough strikes to do this sort of thing. And he's really been rewarding their trust.
Yeah. One, I mean, they're just going to have so many options, like, and that doesn't just help in terms of, you know, guys who could give you a good start, but also it means you don't really have to mess around and hope that somebody figures it out in the postseason. You can go to the bullpen pretty quick and reasonably expect that guy to give you 3, 4, 5 innings. It's not just the guys we've talked about, but I mean, they've got a guy in Camden Sewell who has like been very open about the fact that I want to be a starter and there just hasn't been room for him. And, you know, he talks about it and Tony Vitello talks about it. Like, this is a guy who wants to be a starter and he's been really good out of the bullpen. He gives them multiple innings just about every time out. So they're really running like 6, 7 deep with guys that could probably do that. And that's just a real luxury. I mean, there's luxuries on luxuries here, right? They have the personnel and also they have enough leeway in the SEC that they can really just use these last couple of weekends to mess around, which is like a nice problem to have if you can get it figured out.
No doubt about that. So we'll see what they decide to do this weekend when they announce starters for this. And it is interesting as well, since they ran Thursday through Saturday the last 2 weeks and will again this week, and then rolling into Hoover, they really can set up their pitching staff however they want going into the SEC tournament. All right, let's flip to the ACC. There was a top 10 matchup in the ACC. This is how loaded the weekend was, that we're, I don't know, 40 minutes into this podcast, 50 minutes into the podcast, maybe an hour. I have no idea. I've lost track of time. And we're just getting to this top 10 ACC series in Blacksburg. Virginia Tech, Louisville. Louisville won on Friday. Looked pretty good doing it. Then Virginia Tech comes back, wins the next two games, wins the series, all but assures themselves of a top 8 national seed. Virginia Tech is up to number 3 in the Baseball America top 25. They are not in first place in the ACC, in part because they are missing a couple games. Now, they were against Notre Dame. Who knows how they would have turned out, but they are still trailing Miami for the top spot in the ACC. But Virginia Tech beat Miami. And the way Virginia Tech's playing right now, I don't really see how anyone can make the argument that Virginia Tech is not the best team in the ACC.
Yeah, I mean, they might not end up with that crown just by, you know, technicality. But yeah, I mean, they're to win this, to fight through this series the way they did after losing 8-1, on Friday is impressive. You know, and they did it in different, you know, that there wasn't a game where their offense really exploded. The offense did just enough. I was impressed with the Virginia Tech bullpen. It wasn't, you know, the cleanest. They had some guys give up some runs, but man, they really battled. And that Louisville offense is obviously no joke. We talked about that in the preview episode, and Virginia Tech just kind of came up with the pitches they needed to make. I mean, this really felt, it again speaks to, we're hammering it home, but it speaks to how good this weekend was. This goes under the radar when I watched a pretty decent amount of the last two games of this series, and they felt like postseason atmospheres. Like, these were extremely tense games. And part of that is because the offenses are what they are. You're kind of always waiting for that big, you know, both teams can really just go off at a moment's notice. And so Virginia Tech always felt like, because in both games they took leads and they were kind of just like teetering on the edge of holding those leads. And that's kind of what created that tension. It always just felt like there was one moment away from Louisville just kind of having that big moment and taking over and taking control of the games. And they never really happened the last 2 days, which is a credit to Virginia Tech. And this is a series where I actually come out feeling better about both teams, because the flip side of that is that, you know, Louisville got the win, so didn't get swept. That's great. And that's what you look to do against good teams in conference on the road. And their pitching staff really kind of held Virginia Tech in check for the most part. Now, the hard part with Louisville, because they've done this before, is separating, to use, I think it's a Nate Silver phrase, separating the signal from the noise. Like, I don't know if Carter Lohman pitching as well as he did on Saturday to neutralize the Virginia Tech offense is something that's going to be transferable to next week or the ACC tournament or a regional or what have you, because they have been pretty up and down. But they did show this weekend that, okay, you know, at their best or at a pretty good version of themselves, like, they can do a good job against an offense that's one of the best in the country. And so I come out of it feeling pretty good about both of these teams, which is, you know, you don't always do that. And most every other series we've talked about has had a situation where we come out feeling better about one team and not so good about the other team. This is one where I think both teams can come away with a lot of positives from what they saw.
I think that's right. And, you know, I know Virginia Tech was not thrilled about how that game got away from them on Friday. You can just kind of tell that John Sheff was fuming a little bit in the dugout. But for them to come back and win the series the way that they did, I think that speaks a lot about the toughness mentally that this team has. And that's important because this is a team with no postseason experience. Haven't been to the NCAA tournament since 2013. There's probably a transfer on that roster that's playing in the postseason somewhere, but basically no one has. And so I am curious what it's going to look like when they get into a regional or a super regional and they get punched in the face. They got punched in the face by Louisville on Friday and they answered the bell. And that, to your point, like, this weekend, those kinds of teams in the tense baseball they were playing, pretty good crowds in Blacksburg. This was as much of a postseason test as Virginia Tech could get. And they did really well, you know, in rebounding. And I think that's really significant for a team that is as inexperienced playing meaningful baseball in late May and June as they are.
Real quick on the on Virginia Tech again, to really hammer it home, because, like, I, you know, this, we do not want this to get lost. Oh yeah, that's right. They do the hammer thing. That's right. It's kind of funny. I guess we just take that for granted now. Like, they don't really show that on camera as much, I feel like, or maybe I just wasn't watching when they hit home runs this weekend to see, like, if they did. Anyway, Virginia Tech has done enough this year. Like, Virginia Tech is going to probably be a top 8 seed and be a favorite to go to Omaha. Now, history is littered with teams having their breakthrough season and hosting regionals and getting upset. Like, Virginia Tech has actually done exactly that before. So there's a lot between now and then, but we should not let just kind of the fact that at this point we know what Virginia Tech is, let us lose sight of the fact that Virginia Tech is doing this.
Absolutely. This is a team that they just showed. I'm watching one of the games right now. They just showed a graphic on the screen. This is the second longest postseason drought in the ACC. Only Pitt is longer than them. And this is a team that hasn't ever been a top 8 seed. Like, they've never done what they're doing. This weekend was, and, like, they're in different divisions, so they don't play terribly often, but it was the first time they'd beaten Louisville as a member of the ACC. And I, like, there are just a lot of things like that, you know, we've been used to Tennessee doing these kinds of things the last couple of years. Virginia Tech's doing them right now. And yeah, I mean, it's Virginia Tech. Tennessee has way more history, way more tradition than Virginia Tech. It should absolutely not be lost what the Hokies and are doing this season and what John Schepp has been able to do since he arrived in Blacksburg. I thought the breakthrough was going to happen last year. It faded down the stretch for them. They are not fading this year. They look outstanding as the postseason approaches. All right, let's run down to Tallahassee. It was Florida State and Miami. Rain postponed Friday's game to the opener to Saturday. Miami wins it. They beat Parker Messick. But then Florida State bounces back, wins the next two games, takes the series. Florida State now, you know, that's a huge win, huge series win for their hosting hopes. Miami continues to, they're not in a funk, but they just are not what they were in the first half of the season. I think that's pretty clear. But ultimately, just a really big deal for the Noles to go out and win this this rivalry series.
Yeah, I mean, not always pretty. You know, both the games they won were kind of these weird games where the teams traded blows and Florida State kind of holds on late. But to not get a great Parker Messick start and still manage to win the series, that's huge. I mean, it's not altogether unlike Oregon State, you know, what they were trying to do. It's just the inverse, right? Like, they won the game where their ace didn't pitch so well and then lost the other two games. This was the inverse of that. So they have to feel pretty good about that. I really came away impressed with, I think we talked about this on the preview episode a little bit. One of the things that stands out to me about this Florida State team that I think does give them a little bit of margin for error is, like, the bullpen, when it's throwing well, is really good. You know, when you get into, you know, Crowell and Scalaro and Ross Dunn pitched really well on Sunday. And he's a guy that maybe if Florida State continues to struggle in that third game, you know, Carson Montgomery hasn't really cut it. Like, do you reintroduce Ross Dunn into that mix? You know, he was dominant in that final game. So, like, that's an idea. But I really like this bullpen for Florida State. And so, you know, the combination can be pretty lethal if their starting pitchers are pitching well, or if they just have to stack everyone on the bullpen on Sundays. Like, that is a way they can win games there too. But so that group kind of showed out. And, you know, on the flip side for Miami, like, not unlike Oklahoma State, you know, after Palmquist, there's a lot of question marks. And we know with Rosario, he kind of is what he is. Like, it's shorter outings. It feels like they're always, Miami's always kind of trying to get him out of the games at just the right moment and not let him go too long. Although I guess you could argue maybe that happened in Sunday's game. But, you know, Carson Ligon has given up four or more earned runs in four of his last five ACC starts. You know, he's backslid from when he was, you know, really one of the best freshmen in college baseball, the first, whatever it was, 6 weeks or so of the season. So that puts a lot on Palmquist. And their bullpen is good too, but not quite as good as what we're talking about with Florida State. And so I think this weekend kind of showed with how many innings they had to put on that bullpen where Miami is vulnerable as well.
Big weekend coming up for Miami with Notre Dame on tap. This could become a slide going into the ACC tournament, and that just would not be what you want. A big weekend for the Canes, big weekend for the Irish. Just some very intriguing series that we'll talk about on the preview pod this weekend in the ACC. There's one more weekend for chaos potential. I feel like we've gotten it all season out of this conference. One more good shot at it this weekend with Miami and Notre Dame and Louisville and Virginia, and also a big bubble series with Pitt and Georgia Tech. All right, we're running low on time here, Joe. Quickly, Southern Miss went out and won a series against UTSA. Southern Miss now kind of has consolidated itself as the leader in Conference USA. Still firmly in the hosting mix. What, if anything, did you take from this other than it was just a really fun series in Hattiesburg that deserves more than the 2 minutes we're going to give it here on the podcast?
Yeah, I mean, just the fight from Southern Miss. I mean, they needed it. And they lost the Friday game. So it would have, you know, I have to admit, I was kind of the mind of like, man, did we just miss on Southern Miss? Like, what's going on here? But beyond that, on the field, I like that they won games without having it have to be really clean pitching games. Obviously, they lose the Friday game, but Hurston Waldrop wasn't particularly good on Sunday, and they still figured it out. I think this team having to figure it out is an important piece of the puzzle, because it was never going to be as clean pitching wise as it has, as it was for Southern Miss the first 10 weeks of the season, right? Where it was just like excellent start after excellent start, and they looked untouchable. Like, it wasn't going to be that all season, especially once they got in the postseason. So I do think there is maybe a silver lining here, where the struggles of the last few weeks have kind of given them an opportunity to figure out other ways to win games. And in this week, and that included hitting a million home runs. So I think it was big for them to not completely slip out of the hosting discussion, to kind of fight back a little bit, show some fight ahead of, you know, one more regular season series. But really, I mean, this is a team that they have to do some work next weekend and maybe in the CUSA tournament to really feel good about hosting.
Significantly, Reese Ewing was back in the lineup this week, and he had been a big presence missed in the few weeks that he was sidelined. So to get Ewing back, I think was a big deal, and certainly does help their offense. And they need to help out that pitching staff. It's good enough, but you know, you can't ask that rotation to carry the load the entire season. There are going to be weeks like the last few weeks where they just need a little help from the offense. And this week, unlike in the previous two series losses to UAB and ODU, they were able to get that. And it's going to be a fight to the finish for Southern Miss here if they are able to host. But this was a big step towards that. They could not have withstood another series loss. All right, we covered an awful lot of ground here today. There's plenty more over on the website, baseballamerica.com, if you want to read more. Joe has the full rundown of the top 25, as he always does, what all the top 25 teams did over the last week. Off the Bat, by the time this is posted, I'm sure Off the Bat will be published as well, so you can check out my analysis of the weekend that was in college baseball. There'll be plenty more throughout the week. Remember, this is a short week. Most conference series open on Thursday as we get ready for conference tournaments the following week. So we will be back here a day early with the preview edition of the Baseball America College podcast. So make sure to subscribe to the Baseball America podcast on your favorite podcast app, be that Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Hit the subscribe, hit the follow button, and then it'll pop it right into your phone as we come at you probably on Wednesday here to prep for week 14 of the college baseball season. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy, BA. And this time of year, there's always a lot of stuff going on. There's the projections, there's the analysis, there's us previewing the next week. We're looking ahead to conference tournaments. The first NCAA tournament bid is going to be handed out this weekend in the Ivy League and maybe in the Big West. So a lot happening, a great time to read, to subscribe, to follow us on Twitter, to do whatever you need to do to get ready for the postseason, because it's coming fast. And I know I'm excited for it, and I know Joe's excited for it. And look, if you just listen to 80 minutes of the Baseball America College podcast, I know you're excited for it too. So jump aboard. Hopefully we can have a good time here over the next 5-6 weeks, however long we have until the end of college baseball season. All right, so for Joe, I'm Teddy. Thank you all for listening. We'll talk to you next time.